Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are going back to school. Yes, it's X-Men First Class, and I have Matt on the line. How are you, Matt?
Very good. Good to be here. It's a nice hot summer night here in Virginia. The fireflies are outside, and I've got myself a bourbon and lemonade here ready to go.
The drink of choice when podcasting. And sitting to my right, actually, with two fingers, interestingly, to his temple, is Matt G. How are you, Matt?
I'm dandy on this wet winter's day down here in Sydney Town.
Yeah, it is a bit wet and woolly, isn't it? But that's just the way it is. So we've got X-Men First Class, which I jokingly described as Austin Powers gets some powers and then gets a real gig. So let's start with you, Matt. What did you think of the film?
I was surprised. I really liked it. I'd say this is probably the first X-Men film that I really enjoyed. I saw the other three films, and I remember enjoying the very first X-Men film just because it sort of felt, like a fresh take on the superhero genre at the time. The last two, I wasn't as crazy about. But then this one, really, I thought was probably the most fun of all of them. I really enjoyed it. I thought overall it was a really great film. I really dug the 1960s setting and kind of some of the costumes and the James Bond, albeit ridiculous, but the James Bond submarine thing I thought was really cool. And I liked that they kind of went with the sort of, G-suit / flight suit or whatever for the costumes of the superheroes, as opposed to the ubiquitous kind of black leather, which made it seem kind of more believable. I really enjoyed this movie. I didn't expect a whole lot going into it, and I hadn't really read much about it. I'd seen the trailer, but I went with my son and a couple of his buddies, a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, and all the kids totally dug it too. It was really fun. I had a great time. It was perfect, just kind of light summer superhero fare.
And interestingly, you completely skipped over or had a deliberate mental blackout over Wolverine, the other X-Men film. But Manchi, what did you think?
Oh.
yeah, I thought it was really refreshing. I'm kind of getting to the point of being completely over superhero films, as I'm sure half the world might be getting close to by now. But I found this fun, and it made me want to go back and watch the first X-Men, which I did a couple of days ago. And I understand it's 11 years on since the first X-Men film, but I think this one was a lot more successful, and it gave you time to appreciate the characters a lot more.
Well, of course, this was Bryan Singer returning, in the sense he was a producer on this. He was in the first two X-Men, not in the up its own franchise third one or the somewhat disappointing Wolverine one. So this was initially going to
mention that I never saw that movie, and I totally forgot about it when you said that. I mean, no, it's no joke. It never even entered my mind. That's so funny.
Yeah, a few people wish they could forget about that film. This was going to be a kind of X-Men meets the pianist kind of Nazi original origin story of Magneto. And became, well, I guess, Matt, do you think this is an origin story, or do you think this is a reboot?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? I mean, that scene at the beginning of this film where they do show Magneto in the, sort of the concentration camp, Warsaw ghetto kind of scene where he's separated from his mother. That was, I believe, I don't know if it was a reshoot of the scenes that were at the beginning of the original X-Men, or if it was actually the same shots. I hadn't seen the original X-Men in quite some time, but it was very familiar looking. So either way, I think it was, they tied the two together really interestingly in that way. And I feel like this was in some ways a reboot because you could see them if they wanted to, and it looks like this movie did fairly well at the box office. So I think they certainly could go back and they could start making sort of, another X-Men film using some of these other actors. If they could get James McAvoy to shave his head, I guess, they could.
James McAvoy. I think.
Oh, I do too. Yeah, he's great. I think it would be great to see what they could do with, sort of these actors in some of these roles. There's one actor I think they could lose, but
Who's that?
I mean, she's incredibly beautiful, but January Jones is a terrible actress. I couldn't believe a word coming out of her mouth. I mean, it was just laughable.
Well, she's a bit of an iconic 60s kind of thing. Obviously, this time she's co-starring with a bacon, not with a ham. Sorry about that. I couldn't resist that pun.
Nice.
From her Mad Men days, she's, you know, really heavily associated with that kind of retro period. And certainly she has the look. You just don't think she has the chops when it comes to acting, huh?
Well, I think she could. I mean, I just, you know, take it with a grain of salt. It's my, you know, it's totally subjective. But I just felt that she could have done with a few acting lessons, or maybe a few additional takes, you know, some TLC from the director maybe would have helped a little bit. There were just some of her lines were delivered in a fashion that was so stiff. They were actually audible, like there was audible laughter in the theater when she spoke a couple times where I saw the film. And I was really surprised that people were, you know, that attuned to it, which made me think, boy, it must have really stuck out as, you know, being really flat delivery was all.
I'm just hoping that was a choice for kind of like a camp kind of throwback thing.
Matt, you were commenting on, or you had some comment on the Holocaust beginning, was that right?
Yeah, I think it was actually reshot, shot for shot, up until the point where the kid gets hit in the head with a gun, and then we see a different kind of floating camera in different shots. So I thought that was a really interesting thing to do.
So this obviously has John Dykstra as the head VFX soup, and we like John Dykstra because he's really good, but also he has a really good pedigree for doing, well, basically super person films, because obviously he has origins way back, you know, Star Wars kind of was on that original 77 and Star Trek motion picture, but he was on Spider-Man 1 and 2, did Hancock. And he did, interestingly, the third and fourth Batmans, which I had to really look up to remember. The third one being the Val Kilmer, Nicole Kidman, Jim Carrey, Tommy Lee Jones one. And then the fourth one was the George Clooney, Arnold Schwarzenegger, please can we file that under X-Men Wolverine.
That's the nipple Batman.
The nipple Batman, yeah. but notwithstanding that, which, you know, we're not blaming that at the feet of John Dykstra. John Dykstra has an amazing pedigree for producing really, really good work. But Matt Graham, he actually worked with a lot of different effects houses here. I mean, obviously he was the principal supervisor.
Yeah, I mean, the houses were stretched around the world. I mean, you had Third Floor doing the previews for some of the show, a lot of the part of the show. Digital Domain, we're on it, MPC, CineSite, Rhythm and Hughes, and Luma Pictures were also in there.
And I think you missed Weta, who did...
Of course, yeah, yeah, Weta.
End sequence. In fact, I'd say Weta's stuff was some of the best, well, most considerable contribution to the film. There's a lot of ways you can slice and dice this one in terms of visual effects. You could obviously slice and dice it in terms of the facilities, like who did what. You could also slice and dice it as to the characters and just discussing those. I figure we might as well just hit it more like we normally do in terms of sequences and then kind of work our way down. And on the way, let's see if we can't highlight some of the work that these different facilities did so we can give credit where credit is due. But I will say that Ian Fales at FX Guide's done an amazing job putting together a rundown on the different effects houses. So if you want to look at it from that point of view, drop over to FX Guide, and he's got some really, really good stuff there. And I was lucky enough to actually be at Third Floor, Matt, just recently, in fact, last week, and we ran through the previs on X-Men for the end sequence, the stuff that Weta then did. And I really like Third Floor. You know what? Third Floor is now the largest previs house in the world because it's done the link up to the UK now. So it's literally the largest previs company in the world. And they've ironically extended. I don't know if you've ever been there in LA. It's on the top of that thing down on Wilshire. But it's extended and it's taken over another floor. And ironically, it's taken over the third floor of that building. But I know that there are people there that actually listen to this show because they came up to me and they said how much they enjoyed it. So shout out to Third Floor. But let's get going with the beginning. We've already touched on the Nazis, but should we discuss the effects sequence? What did you think, Matt, of the sequence where Magneto, as he is not quite yet, gets obviously horrendously upset over his mother's death and starts ripping the place apart?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that stuff was great. I think it was, you know, the overall production design of the camp and of the room. It was a little sort of striking to me. I was surprised to see
it was sort of jarring when they were having the conversation. Kevin Bacon shot his mother, which was kind of disturbing. And then they had a take that then went sort of, the camera went back sort of almost, I think, behind Kevin Bacon's shoulder, and you saw that there was this whole glass room sort of behind them with all the. And I remember when I saw that in the theater, I was like, well, wait, what? Like, where is this? Like, where am I now? Like, it was sort of a jarring moment in the edit, but I thought the utilization of all the sort of stainless steel and whatnot, the medical stuff in that room, and the way in which things kind of started moving around a la Magneto's rage, I thought was pretty good. There was nothing in that that really didn't work for me. I didn't see anything that really stuck out as being bad. I just the thing that really stuck out to me was the sort of geography of that space. I was surprised when it was sort of revealed that space as in the back. I wasn't really sure where that came from.
Matt Graeber, you probably got the strongest editing chops of the three of us. Did they cross the line to come around to reveal that? Because I remember the same thing. It was like a really jarring shot. I remember thinking it was quite impactful, but it didn't feel like they'd done a sort of pullback reveal. It almost felt like they crossed the line to do the reveal. Did you notice that?
I can't remember if they crossed the line, but it was like another step of his evilness. I mean, you just see him shoot his mum, and then bang, you see this room of torture, and you're like, what the frig is that? So I liked it. Just wasn't 100% sure about the glass and how it was constructed, because there's a lot of big chunks of metal flying around, and that glass didn't break at all.
You mean the glass between him and the room?
Yeah, I understand.
I was waiting for that to break. I think we ended up pulling out from the exact opposite side to the reveal side, right? So he must have swung around at some point on the edit, because the shot that's the jarring one, that maybe deliberately jarring, was when it's Kevin Bacon camera left, the mother and the head-crushed Nazis right, and the end shot, I'm pretty sure, is pulling out the opposite way, so Kevin Bacon's desk would be camera... he was camera left, he's then camera right on the end shot. But that's kind of an editing thing, I guess. I mean, if it had an impactful kind of moment, you know, maybe it was a good use of breaking the rules of
You're allowed to cross the line if it's for a good creative, impactful thing.
Though it is visually confusing, and the question is, does it give you impact, or does it get you to a point where you're taken out of the movie because you're going, what did just happen? And I think that was definitely borderline between those two, because I'm more for breaking the rules if you can, but not if it break the rule and then you go, huh, what just happened? I'm sitting in a cinema and I don't understand it.
Yeah, it's the only time in the film where I really felt like that was something that occurred that I had that reaction to. So I don't, I feel like it's pretty forgivable. And maybe, maybe it's one of those things too where it just struck me odd at the moment when I saw it. And if I were to see it again, maybe I could look at it with a different, a different set of eyes. But my first take on it was that it was a little bit jarring. But I was going to say, I did also really like the helmet crushing. I thought that was really nice. It was very kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, it was sort of Raiders thing for me as well. Yeah, it was like I was waiting for faces to dissolve.
Yeah.
See, one of the most jarring things of the film for me was just after that scene where you see him in the future further down the line, and he's in his hotel room in Geneva, and you've got that giant matte painting of the vista out the window. That felt really jarring for me. It was just like, what are they trying to do there? It looks like a postcard's just been stuck in the back of that window.
yeah. Well, I mean, there's a bunch of small effect shots, but am I right in thinking the next big effect shot is when we've got the ship attack with the anchor? I mean, that's that big sequence.
That was NPC's small effects work.
When we get the backstory on Charles as a child. Mm-hmm. And then obviously little effect shots pop through. But was there another big sequence before we hit the ship attack? I don't think I was in my notes.
I don't think so either. Not that I can think of.
Okay, well, maybe there was and we'll come back to it. But certainly for me, a sequence that stood out was that using the anchor chain to smash the ship apart, obviously the sub escaping. And that was also the first point around that time that when the sub came out of the bottom of the ship that I was like, are they going to be frickin' sharks with frickin' lasers? And the more they went into that sub with the plush white carpets, the more I was like, it was basically like, evil masterminder go-go.
He was missing a hat.
What?
He was missing a cat.
He was missing a cat. Yeah, a shaved cat. I don't know that I really hated that. I would have been upset if the film had taken itself too seriously, so maybe that's a good place for it not to take it, but it really was dancing between silly and...
Well, but I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I hear what you're saying about the Austin Powers vibe, and I mean, you know, I guess you can never escape that. But, you know, I had recently been going back and I've been listening to, what's it called, the talk show with, I guess it's Dan Benjamin and John Gruber, and it's been so much fun. They've been going back and they were rewatching all of the James Bond films. And so they went back and they watched all the original James Bonds. And I mean, those guys are pretty funny. They've been sort of goofing on, you know, the whole Bond franchise and some of the characters and some of the plot devices that are utilized over and over again. And I do think that, you know, this really did pay sort of homage in a lot of ways to some of those early James Bond things and some of those films from that era, too, like even getting right down to the design of the war room, the U.S. war room, which was totally just straight out of Dr. Strangelove. I mean, it's that same exact set piece, you know. And I think that, you know, it is a fine line between that and Austin Powers. I mean, I think the Mike Myers character, you know, he kind of takes all of those sort of sexy 1960s cliches, the go-go boots and the, you know, the white super subs of the, you know, Bond villains and stuff, and really makes it something that you kind of almost can't take seriously. But I actually felt like it worked in this movie. I didn't, you know, it was funny, but at the same time, you know, there was a time before Austin Powers when all that stuff was cool, you know, and you would look at that and you'd see all that Bond stuff and you'd be like, oh man, that's so badass. Like, I wish I had a Lotus that could, you know, turn into a submarine and go underwater.
When you were like 12.
If we were supervillains back in the 60s, you know, we would have a sub like that.
And if we were not, we'd get Weta to hand a sub over to NPC and have them take that asset and make it drop out of the bottom of a luxury boat. So, okay, so NPC Vancouver does the destruction of the boat that I'm liking so much with the chain. And I do like, obviously, I like the in this world, what you can come up with as ways to manipulate metal to attack people. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously, it's easy just to make metal turn into bullets and shoot people. And why he doesn't do that all the time, I don't know. But leaving that aside, I liked that destruction with the anchor. I thought it was really well done. Apparently, the guys at NPC Vancouver had just developed like a whole new destruction toolkit they used on Sucker Punch. And that's what they were using in this. They had like a LiDAR scan of the boat and they did it all in Maya and stuff. But they used their own sort of special destruction toolkit, which I believe is called something like Kali or K-A-L-I, I think it is. Anyway... it's obviously very good at doing, you know, breaking up geometry into sub geometries and stuff for rips and smashes and crashes. And I thought that looked really good, as did the CG water that they did in Flowline. I thought that whole sequence looked really, really good.
Yeah, the chain going through the boat was the one scene when afterwards I asked my wife, she came with us, me and the boys that went, she came with, and I said, what did you think was the best effect in the movie? Just seeing what she would say, kind of a layman, you know, layman's view, and she thought the tearing apart of the boat with the anchor was the thing that really she thought was cool, and she's like, oh, but, it, you know, that was probably a miniature, you know, and I think that was kind of my...
miniature, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought, too. Like, when I saw it, I was like, oh, maybe that was a miniature, because it did look really real, which I think is a credit to the group at NPC who did that. If that was indeed all digital, I mean, it really was pretty amazing looking.
Yeah, and I thought it was really, really good. I mean, the sub was, as I say, a Weta thing, but they lent it over to NPC, which highlights what you have to do on a big production like this, where you have to sort of basically share assets around to get both, you know, sort of continuity and stuff. But... generally speaking, obviously it was dark at night, so that helps sort of sell effects, and you can add a bit of smoke in and stuff, and it always sort of looks good. But yeah, those interior shots, I agree with you. When you cut to the interior and they're running and it's smashing, I felt like, well, that must be a miniature, or if it isn't a miniature, it was like either a live set or whatever.
Yeah.
And so obviously there was live action elements in there, but I thought really good sequence. I thought it was NPC London, but I think it was NPC Vancouver that did that, and you know, points to them for a really, really solid sequence. Okay, so at some point after that, they basically enter what the Rat Pack stage of, you know, let's go use the early prototype Cerebro to go find the mutants. And So that sort of brings up what we thought of this, because we got a couple of these in the film where you've got a sequence that we're used to from the other films that we're seeing in an earlier incarnation. Mm-hmm. So that Cerebro, am I saying that right?
Cerebro.
Yeah, it's, yeah. I'm mispronouncing
close
it.
Close enough.
Anyway, I think that was done by CineSite. Matt, was that right? Matt G?
I think it was a CineSite. That's correct. Are you talking about the interior shots?
Where he does his first run through, you know, the kind of black and white. At the CIA, there's that geodesic dome thing outside, and he they wander in. It's the first version of it that's created by Hank, right?
Yeah. I don't know if it was the same people that did the Cerebro black and white imagery stuff or the interior of Cerebro, because that was all shot on green screen as well, and all those walls were replaced as well.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting that Cerebro, those scenes were actually shot on the Genesis camera. I think it was for ramping the shots.
Because the rest of it was shot on film, right?
Yeah.
Like classically on film. And it was a 2.35 delivery, I think.
Yeah, and again, the Cerebro thing, they had to kind of make it fit into what we'd seen 11 years earlier. So they had to keep in the same kind of design aesthetic, which I think this time they went a bit more desaturated on the colours.
Well, we would see 11 years later.
Sorry. Oh, yes, good point. Well, many more years later. But another one.
Did you
those,
like it?
Yeah, I liked it. I dug it. I thought it was really important that they did actually keep to the same look and feel of the original use of Cerebro that we see several years later. So, yeah, I thought it was good that they kept to that rather than trying to redefine the whole thing and go too crazy with it.
Because CineSite also did, speaking of retro stuff, that great Soviet Red Square stuff, you know, the which was really a pretty short sequence when, you know, the guy who's going to get axed, what was the guy's name? You know, there was a general colonel. I'm sorry, I've lost the character's name, but, you know, he was the evil Kremlin guy. And you just have him basically watching a May Day parade in Red Square. And for a shot that didn't last very long, I would have been like, oh man, I've just built this entire parade. Can't we have more of that? I actually fully expected that. You know, in the old days, and I'm sure you can remember this, Matt, you'd see a shot like that and you just knew that if you're building that many assets, you'd have to come back to it and it'd play in the scene. Otherwise, no one would have the budget to make it. But
yeah.
It came and it went.
I think that's one of those things that's so great, though. I mean, I do have to say I love it when, you know, a filmmaker or an effects supervisor and a filmmaker together make the production team make the decision that, like, all right, well, you know, we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to build this out. We're going to have to, you know, spend the time for this shot because it's a really important element of the story or whatever, and they do it. But then they aren't showy about it, you know. It just becomes a part of the background. It's all in service to the story. And I think when filmmakers embrace effects in that way, I think it's really great.
The background of that shot was great, and again, I loved the detail there, but just the comping of the general or colonel or wherever he is as he's coming back inside with the blown-out sky, that part of the shot
I agree with you on that one. It didn't totally nail it, did it?
One of the weaker ones, but there were so many awesome shots later on in the film, so.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably a bit of a throwaway thing, but yeah, I remember at the time thinking it wasn't quite everything that it could be, but I do think that the Red Square stuff was good. Well, CineSite, of course, would play a huge role in the next sequence, which in my kind of rough running list would be the attack on the CIA, because after they've done their whole Rat Pack thing, and before we get onto that, I should say, I do totally think that the Wolverine cameo in the Rat Pack sequence was awesome. That, I mean, just from a plot point of view, very funny. Our audience at the preview screening just laughed out loud at that.
Same with the audience I saw with it. People burst out laughing. They thought that was great.
Yeah. But so they do the whole Rat Pack thing and they go around gathering up people, and we've got some nice sequences. I'll come back to discussing the angel stuff because she'll play obviously in the end sequence. But we have that attack on the CIA headquarters, bunker, whatever you want to call it. And I was going to say, CineSite did Azazel's, I guess it's what, father of Nightcrawler? Is that established in the film, or does everyone just assume that he's the father of Nightcrawler? Do you want to know?
I don't think it's really established in the film, but I think in the mythology of X-Men, everyone's supposed to know. I didn't realize it until after the film.
Because it's obviously, it is sensibly a linked-looking effect or derivative effect. But
yeah, I didn't realize that until you just said that. But I mean, it was the same effect as Nightcrawler. I actually sort of made the assumption it was maybe the same character, but...
Did you get that Havok was Cyclops' brother?
Oh, no. I didn't realize that.
Oh, dudes, where have you been?
I'm not steeped in my X-Men lore as much as I should be, I guess.
Okay. So what did we think? Because I thought, as I said when we, I think, reviewed the first film that actually had Nightcrawler, that not only did I think that was a wickedly good effect, but I thought the sound effects worked really well with it. I thought the kind of sucking of the air once he vanished, the kind of implode thing, that it was just... I remember seeing it, you know, we did the attack on the president. It was just wicked. And we've seen it a bit more now, but nevertheless, it is still a really well-executed, very professional-looking piece of
footage. Wasn't it... I remember reading a lot... I think it was... Wasn't it Steven Rosenbaum who was... who kind of headed up the Nightcrawler effect on the first film that we saw that in, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's correct, but I have some vague memory of that. But no, I thought it worked great in this film too. I liked that, you know, it was red this time instead of, I guess, the more sort of bluish black color that you see in the previous iteration, the previous film, which is later in time, I guess. But I thought that stuff was great. I have that listed as one of my sort of best effects in the film, and I think it just they took what had been done before, the look and feel of that, and I don't know if I would say they necessarily improved on it so much as they just they lived up to the original. I think it really worked great.
Yeah. I mean, it is a fluid sim, which we are probably more comfortable with now. So, you know, with that great sort of turbulence and kind of vapory kind of smoke sim, I guess it is. But they also did other stuff, right? Like his kind of dragon-esque, or I guess devil-esque, stabbing tail
thing,
which could have looked silly, and I think didn't. It looked kind of pretty vicious and pretty, you know, ninja-esque badass. So, Matthew, what do you think? Was he an evil enough warrior?
I liked him, but I actually found the disappearing trick worked better in the nighttime shots than at the daytime shots when we get to the island near the end.
Right, near the Cuban Missile Crisis thing.
Yeah. I'm just wondering why that is. I mean, is it a contrast thing, or is it because of having a darker background rather than a lighter background is
helping? I think you'd lose more in the darker than in the light, wouldn't you? You think you'd actually not be able to see the effect as well.
Yeah, it just felt...
That whole popping up in and dropping people off up in the sky was a wickedly evil way of killing people. All right. Well, let me get your opinion then on Diamond Girl. Now, we leave away, you know, January Jones' gorgeous acting discussion that we had earlier. Just from an effects point of view now, Matt G, what did you think of the... I mean, did you buy she was made of diamonds and yet was still moving?
Yeah. I mean, I can appreciate how incredibly hard it would have been for them to create her to do that. I know they did all the modeling in Maya and rendered it in Ren, and but their big problem was not they couldn't actually achieve the specific look straight out of the render, just because it's hard to get a human form to keep a human character and emotion with made up of tiny little diamonds. So they had to make various sizes for different parts of the body to help be expressive.
So how do you mean? Sorry. You mean that the diamonds were different sizes, or?
Yeah, different sizes and shapes to, A, create the body, and also to help give it more humanistic characteristics. And even as she's transforming from human to Diamond Girl, Houdini was actually used to do the transformation from one to another. And then, yeah, the bulk of the diamond form was modelled in Maya, which I thought was kind of cool. And on set, they used the chrome balls and grey balls. And then they also had a 4-inch cubic zirconia, which was just to help them figure out what the diamond surface would look like in that environment.
Because Houdini seems to be the go-to thing for a lot of that effects stuff. But you were saying that was only used in the transition?
Yeah.
And so that was, I guess, done at multiple points through the film. But I think there was one thing that I was reading that was interesting, that you'd think that if she was just having a digital person, you'd just do a motion capture of her. But I think there were scenes where she was going to and from Diamond, whether it was this scene or another scene, which would have caused, did cause, from what I read, the guys huge amounts of problems, because obviously they needed to not have her in a motion capture suit, because she was in her underwear most of the time, it seemed.
They had a lot of problems with that, and lots of match moving and witness cameras to help them solve all that.
But it struck me that probably would have also had quite a lot of work in just removing January Jones, because you know, there's not like an automatic button that just removes a character from a scene so you can put another one in. And presumably, you know, some of it was obliterated by compositing over the top of it, but there would have sort of been a fair amount of background removal.
Yeah, the guys at Rhythm and Hughes did a great job on her. They did a lot of those characters. They did Angel and Mystique and Diamond Girl, Emma Frost. But, yeah, I think it was really, really successful.
I actually thought Angel, the whole wings thing from the tattoo, was better, in a sense, than January Jones's Diamond Girl. And the reason why is I don't think I ever got past feeling like I was looking at a low poly count 80s SIDGRAPH paper on human motion with January Jones as Diamond Girl, because, you know, obviously she was not going to look like a person because she was made of diamonds, but it just had this faceted low poly count look that I couldn't get past. And I don't think they could have done anything different because that's exactly what it should be. Mm. But the tattoo to wings thing, I thought that was great. Did anyone else sort of like the tattoo thing? I mean, she's obviously, this is, you know, when they were, they showed it initially, I think, when they were doing it. They found her at the strip club.
Yeah, no, I thought that was really nice, too. I thought that worked well. I was on the diamond effect. I was going to say, you know, I thought the diamond, the shader was pretty cool looking, and that it reminded me some of what we had talked about on an earlier show about the Rainbow Bridge in Thor. Yep. You know, it has a really sort of different, unique look, and it's got a lot of sort of sparkle to it, some interesting things with regards to the refraction of the light and the background sort of seen through the diamond. And I thought that it was a cool effect. It was something I don't know that I had seen before anywhere. I agree that, you know, it's one of these things that it feels like it has problems, but I think it feels like it has problems because, you know, it's so fantastical that it's almost, there's really no point of reference from which you could look at that and see it moving and talking and blinking and really make any sense.
I don't think they could have done it any better. Like, I don't think that it was badly executed. It's just the problem is that, let's take an eyebrow or an eye. So you have an enormous amount of subtlety that goes around an eye. But the second you go faceted on diamonds, you don't have subtlety of what's going on the eyebrow because there has to be a large facet, say an inch above the eyebrow. Otherwise, it's a smooth diamond. Round curve doesn't read like diamond. So the second you start going to this faceted look, you're killing your ability to get subtlety into the performance because the granularity of the polygons, as it were, which I know they're not polygons in a single sense, but you know what I mean, like that surface facet, that granularity is fighting your, which is exactly why I reminded me of low poly counts from the 80s. Now, do I think that it looked like bad poly count from the 80s? Well, no, it didn't, because it looked freaking awesome in terms of its render shaders. I just don't think you could ever get past it looking like CG because in my head, I don't know anybody else's, it just said, we don't have enough granularity for the subtlety of the human pores and subsurface scattering and all the things that make things look... Because she's made of goddamn diamonds, for crying out loud.
Yeah, you start thinking about Lawnmower Man or something, you know, for a second.
But it's not that they've done anything wrong. I mean, if
no, you're right. I totally understand what you're saying. I think that's a good point. I mean, it's a subtle distinction between the two. But I think, you know, what you're saying with that the design of the character and the nature of, you know, a cut diamond, what it looks like is a low poly render. Like, you're stuck.
Yeah.
You know, you're trapped by the design of the thing. Yeah.
Yeah, which is why when they first got, you know, refraction working, they did renders of diamonds.
Yeah.
I mean, it refracts really well.
Sure. Yeah.
and so if you look at a shot of her, you're not reading, like, any nuances in the face because you can't put nuances in the face because you don't have enough subtlety of manipulating the surface. And even if you could, you've got all this internal, gorgeous, lovely refraction, reflection stuff, which kind of fights your ability to read shade and read form. And so it's like whoever came up with her being diamond is...
Her wooden performance really helped the effects team in that.
Matt G, help me out here. Do you think she... Didn't she just feel a bit CG, no matter that you couldn't pick apart that it had been any way badly done or not?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most successful parts of it is when she's in that room and she's getting choked by the bed and you start seeing the cracks around her neck. And that's when you start to have a bit more finer detail in there, and then the glass kind of takes its own characteristics as well. So,
well, at the risk of offending Mr. Dykstra, riddle me this, Batman. Doesn't she form up to diamond again at the end? Or am I imagining
that? Oh, she got better.
She got better?
Yeah.
Because I thought the whole point was he cracked her so she could never turn into diamond again.
She got better.
Okay, good. Okay, sure, no problem. Moving on. So we had the whole training camp sequence after the attack at the CIA. Like they go off to become, you know, badass, let's get their sort of things under control, which I've got to say is a fun, whimsical sequence. And, you know, full-on points to the director who actually managed to get a great kind of positive, interesting kind of sense of what was going on. So while the Hellfire Club guys were off doing whatever they were doing, you know, our hero guys get together and go to camp, Camp Charles. And I thought that was a fun sequence. It had, you know, exactly the kind of right vibe. Kids would have loved it. The effects were good.
You got to love a montage.
Yeah, it was a montage, but you know what?
The building sequence. Valid,
it was valid film montage, and it was funny, and it you knew there were going to be jokes as they, you know, got control. But pushing him off the top of the dish, you know, it was all funny and good and worked well, I thought. It was.
Yeah, I think from a script point of view, I think it was really great. And then I think, too, you know, it gave the audience an opportunity. The thing with the X-Men film films, I think that's difficult is you're dealing with so many characters. It's really an ensemble piece as a superhero film. And so for the audience, certainly an audience member who maybe isn't as steeped in the lore of the X-Men history, you know, you really have to spend some significant screen time if you want people to care about these characters, letting the audience know who they are. And a sequence like that, I think, is really useful in doing something like that. And I really enjoyed all the humor, like, you know, with, I can't remember the character's name, but the guy, the sound wave guy or whatever.
Banshee,
yes. He, when he's sitting on the windowsill and he's got that kind of goofy looking, you know, sort of Da Vinci-esque wingsuit thing on, and he says, like, you know, it's going to work. You say this is going to work, and he's like, yeah, it's going to work great. You just scream, like, as you get closer to the ground, and they sort of push him off the windowsill, or he jumps off, and he falls into the bushes, you know? I mean, and then they do the same thing again later, but, you know, it's sort of the moment where of truth where it has to work, and, I mean, that stuff was really fun, and it had a, I mean, it almost... You know, the look of that flying, to me, it looked more like that initial flying sequence. Anyway, it reminded me so much more of the Harry Potter, the look of it, something about the angle of that shot and sort of being at the apex of where he rises up before he starts to fall again. Like, it really, it looked straight up. It looks just like some shot right out of a Harry Potter movie where they're flying around on their
So the Lumiere Pictures did that, right? They did Banshee and Havoc, and I think they did Darwin as well. But I think what was interesting about that is, I don't know if you've seen any behind-the-scenes stuff, but you know, obviously that windowsill, for example, that was just a green screen thing that he was, you know, the rest of the building was put in. Obviously the same with the radio dish. And that's not taking anything away from that because it was good compositing and good everything. But I'm really critical normally of those flying shots. Now, you referenced Harry Potter. As Potter got on, the flying shots got better. But even in like a Superman film or whatever, you'll get them flying around and it just feels like the direction that they're flying is not with the sort of G-force that they're indicating with their body and the camera is wrong and they drift relative to the ground. And they actually shot him on wires in blue screen and they had a camera on a track. I don't know if you saw this, Matt G, and there was like a huge long track and they sort of shot the camera down the track to fly past him in flying suit hanging on wires in a kind of a U-shaped... blue screen set, so you would actually, or green screen, so you'd actually get real camera footage of him flying past camera at speed, but of course he was not flying past the camera was flying past him. But it was therefore, like, you know, live action elements, no sensible tracking to be speaking of, put into shots both there and at the end. And I've got to say, there was a couple of shots, especially at the flying at the end over water looking down with specular highlights on the water, that I just thought were really good flying shots, and I think they're hard to do.
I was going to say, you know, that's another thing I had on my list of, like, right after I saw it, I sort of made a list of, like, best and worst in the show. And the flying stuff, when they're seen, in particular, from far away, and they're sort of somewhat silhouetted in front of the water, the high-speed motion of that. And
wasn't that good?
I thought it was fantastic, and it was some of the best flying stuff that I've ever seen in a film, to be honest with you. And I actually thought that it worked great when we saw them from a little bit further away and they were somewhat in silhouette, and it kind of had a little bit of that, you know, what some people would say maybe they're not as crazy about, but I think I still got to say I think it's great because I think it's what would happen. But sort of, you know, the Battlestar Galactica, the reimagining, the TV,
finding
them, yeah, like where the camera's kind of searching and seeking and zooming in, and it kind of had a little bit of that feel. And I personally, even though people might say that's become really trendy and, oh, yeah, I'm so sick of that, I love that. I think it's real. I think it looks believable. Mm. And this had that kind of vibe going on. But I would say that some of the close-ups in the flying characters in the end sequence, I thought some of those comps for me didn't work as well. The close-ups.
I think it was more though Angel's comps than his comps, weren't they? Or do you think it was both?
Yeah, they had that kind of feel where she was just hanging from a wire and, yeah, going for the close-up so we don't actually have to show too much behind her.
Yeah, those just didn't work as well. And I think it was a compositing issue, maybe in conjunction with a lighting issue on the practical side. They didn't quite jive with sort of the incredible dynamic. And what I really do think it's probably some of the best like human flying stuff I've ever seen.
Yeah, that was awesome. Mm.
Just going to say, one of the other techniques which I really liked about some of that flying stuff is they actually threw the actors on harnesses and flew them with helicopters. Just to get some of the cool flying shots as well.
Just hanging out and really over water or something? Or?
I don't know if it was over... It must have been either over water or something nice and soft. But I just thought that was interesting that they wanted to really make sure those flying scenes were believable. So I guess intercutting between the helicopter kind of stuff, the giant flying camera stuff, it just helped really pull those scenes off.
Hey, getting back before we leave the training sequence altogether and start on this battle sequence, which we're sort of almost done... I just didn't want to talk about the feet because Hank, you know, on his transition to Beast, you have a big kind of Morphe feet shot with some, I think, wickedly modeled and sculpted feet. I mean, whoever was using ZBrush or, you know, whatever they were using, Mudbox for that, just deserves points because way to go on good veined feet. But what did you think, Matt, on the transition from one to the other? And then I'll ask you, Matt G.
I mean, I liked it. It reminded me of, you know, what I still look back on as some of the best, you know, effects transition stuff of my youth would be, you know, the old American Werewolf in London, as well as the original John Carpenter's The Thing, you know, which I guess was a remake of another movie, but it had that kind of, you know, it looked like a prosthetic. It didn't look real CG Morphe to me. I thought it looked, you know, like it could have been some weird practical set of bladders and, you know, whatnot in a latex foot with a frame or something. But, you know, with like hairs coming out of it and stuff. You know, I mean, it looked like one of those things from that era. And I really liked it. I thought it was cool. And it's one of the ones I actually didn't make a note of, and I actually, you know, hadn't. Remembered that shot, but that's a neat moment in the film when he, you know, we see his feet transition. I thought it was weird that, though, from a plot point of view, that he had such an issue with his physical appearance, but yet at the same time, it seemed as though he was able to hide his physical manifestation of his mutation simply by putting on some shoes. I didn't quite understand.
I have to say that if you start going there on motivation of plot for that kind of stuff, I think you're going to really get hurt.
Yeah.
I'm going to hurt you. Manching, what did you think of that? But also, didn't NPC also go on to do some face replacements on Beast in the...
End, I think, where Beast is flying the awesome... was it Bluebird? Blackbird?
SR-71.
I was surprised that they did full CG face replacements there. They looked great.
They've got hair down, haven't they? Because the hair was what would kill that. The close-ups would die if that hair wasn't going well, and it was on the face, I think.
Yeah, but the eyes and the teeth, it all looked
true. Perfect. They weren't the actor's eyes?
No, I think it was, from what I've read somewhere, it was all CG.
Cool. That is good, actually. Yeah, I mean, I guess we're kind of... Plot-wise, I'm a little... I mean, I get that it's cool that he's Beast, and I get the whole, you know... I mean, I liked Kelsey Grammer playing that role later. He did seem to be suddenly become a huge badass character over what was a kind of timid guy, but I guess you'd do that if you turn into a werewolfy kind of thing. But yeah, from an effects point of view, I think points to the guys. Okay, so that brings us to the big kind of stuff. We've got other effects going on, but with big end sequence, which kind of you've got Digital Domain doing the wobbly head, I'm going to suck a nuclear reaction into my body for no apparent reason, Bacon sequence, and you've got Weta doing the, you know, showdown, basically battleship spectacular, which I think the funniest part of which has got, you know, not a lot to do with visual effects, but a little bit, which is that they wanted to have that Cuban island or Cuban-esque island for the sequence at the end, and they went to Georgia to do it, and apparently they planted hundreds of bloody palm trees to make that look like it was a Caribbean kind of island when it was actually on the east coast of America. But the thing about it is that within 2 days or so, the palm trees had gone brown, because guess what? Palm trees don't really like being on this island. And so they had to put in CG fixes to the palms and then CG trees full stop. So
oh, really? Wow.
I just think it was hysterically funny that in a sequence where you'd think you've got all this trouble of setting up an island, and the one of the few things they would give the VFX artist is, no, we really will create a tropical island, so you have to do the whole thing. It was like, it didn't work. Yeah, you have to do that as well. You have to do the flotilla, the boats, the missiles, the characters, and we're not even into the trees, yeah.
So. There was one establishing shot on that beach that was really tough from a digital comping point of view, where it's either the camera's either moving forward or pulling back, and trees kind of come into frame. And that was one shot that I had a note of that was like, I can't remember exactly where it takes place in the sequence, so maybe it's kind of a moot comment, but it was one part where I thought, just the overall feel, the movement of the camera and the design of the shot, it felt really flat and super CG. It looked totally not real to me, but...
I will match your CG trees with, I thought the battleships, even though they weren't battleships in the Cuban Missile Crisis, I thought the rockets, battleships, the sims of the clouds, of the puffs of smoke as they fire, the water sims on yanking the subs out of the water, all of that stuff, huge amount of stuff if you think about it, was awesome. Just really good.
Did you though, okay, I will concur, the sub coming out of the water... totally awesome. The below the water, but like coming up, breaking the surface of the water, all the sort of fine mist, the heavy aerated water coming off the sub, fantastic, incredible, great. But you didn't feel like ever in the issues or in the shots of the battleships and stuff when we see the Armada. Did you ever look at those and feel like there were some scale issues there at all? Or did it... Because that's the thing I saw. When I saw those, not in every shot, but there was maybe, I don't know, half a dozen, maybe 10 shots, maybe a dozen shots.
I
looked at it and I thought there were some scale problems. Like, they looked like, you know, quarter scale miniatures. Like, they looked small. And
I didn't have a problem with the scale, though I do think that they weren't... Like, this film at this point was 60s pop perky, and if you wanted to do a better battle armada-y thing, you could go to Clint Eastwood's Iwo Jima, or you could go to even the TV show Pacific, where they did some awesome stuff, obviously for a TV show, but nevertheless just really, really good of the flotillas. But then they could be grittier... grayer, greener, bluer, more kind of... This had to be perky, sort of... Because everything was in bright color, sun...
Juicy colors, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I thought maybe the scale issues, too, might have even been, like, a camera problem or a lens issue, where it was, like, they were shooting and they were rendering the scenes with a lens that... Where the effect, in terms of the scale... Like, some of the ships just felt small, I guess, and I couldn't quite put my finger on how that was the case or why it was the case that they looked small, but there were a few shots where they felt tiny. They didn't feel like big battleships the size of what they should have been to me.
What do you think, Matt? In a couple of those.
Well, I didn't notice any scale issues or anything for me, but I didn't even think about that scene as an effect scene. To tell you the truth, until I got out of the film, I believed it. I loved it. I loved all the action that was happening up until, you know, when the plane and the sub crash on the island, and then I was just kind of slightly removed. And I think some of those shots were just lingered on for a bit too long and allowed you to see some of the not as perfect and awesome stuff. But the initial Armada stuff, I loved it.
I mean, I think the water sims, I think they were using exotic media stuff and Weta's own stuff.
Yeah, that was...
Weta just has that down. I mean, remember last year they won the Avatar water sequence where she's drinking from the leaf was like best VFX shot of the year. Like, Weta can do water.
Yeah, I think they were using Naiad and their Synapse water sim stuff.
Yeah, I have to... I don't know if he worked on this show, but I have to give a shout-out to my buddy Kevin Ramond, who has been in New Zealand for a long time. He's been one of the lead water TDs at Weta for quite some time. He's really great at it, so I'm sure he works with... If he didn't work on the show, he worked with those guys.
Because they did, 350 shots, Matt G, and on, it was on Weta, and that was... Now, obviously, Third Floor done really good previews on it and stuff, and as I say, I think that you'd never had a sort of a evil, threatening, kind of military-esque kind of vibe, because it wasn't graded that way. Everything was, you know, perky and sunny. But then, you know, it wasn't the Caribbean, and it, you know... I thought the pulling the sub out of the water could have been lame, and it wasn't, so that's why I think that was good. The only thing I didn't like is nothing really... I don't think it was a visual effects problem. It's just every time we cut to the bridges, it felt like those bridges weren't in the same place as the rest of the story. They just felt like on a soundstage, because it seemed like we're looking straight into the front of them. It was like, okay, we'll make sure that we can't... Like, didn't feel like...
I do have to say one thing, like one shot from the bridge of one of the ships when I believe it's when they first... The X-Men first kind of arrive on the scene, and they're in the SR-71 and the Blackbird or whatever, and you see it kind of whizzing by, and the captain on one of the ships, the lead captain that we see, he puts the binoculars up to his face, and we see a shot of the Blackbird through the binoculars, and it's a really short shot, but the look of the ship. The plane through the binoculars and the lighting on the ship. There's on the plane. There's a tiny little glint off the canopy, and you can see some of the modeling detail in the plane. And it's a really quick shot, but I remember when I saw it, I just thought, man, that looks good. Like it was a great shot, like that had the right kind of depth of field and stuff that you'd get by looking through a pair of binoculars. And it was just a really super hyper photorealistic looking shot. I totally dug it.
Someone gave it with some love.
But don't you think like
it,
when they...
It felt like Matt, it, yeah.
But when you cut to the just bridges, like Matt G, that was just... There were some shots that just felt like there were eight guys standing around a soundstage looking out a window that wasn't there. I don't know, it just didn't feel like we kind of needed to move inside the bridge and outside the bridge a bit more. It was just like, cut to bridge, it's been an honor serving with you, you know.
Yeah, I felt like we were cutting back and forth a bit too much with the missiles when they're, you know, floating in midair, and also with the bridge stuff. The person I went and saw the film with, actually, one of the major criticisms they said afterwards was some of those comps of the bridge stuff. I didn't notice it so much, but it obviously was jarring.
You know, the other thing I thought was a little bit problematic that I felt like could have used a little more... a little more love was when the Blackbird is hovering for a time, which you know, one, I don't think that plane can do that, but it's still no, regardless
I didn't think
of
so
that.
Either.
No, I think the Harrier jump jet was the first time we actually saw that.
Regardless of that, you know, were it the case that it could do that, I had an issue with the heat distortion from the hovering thrusters. It looked like they really just threw a straight up. Just like a blur rather than the kind of really nice sort of displacement kind of distortion that you'd actually see were it to be, you know, in situ like that, where it's really happening. Kind of like the, I still, you know, look back at some of the best heat distortion stuff is the stuff from True Lies, you know, where they added all that. And they did a lot of great stuff again in Avatar. There was some great heat distortion. But the stuff that we saw coming out of I noticed it right away, maybe only because I've had to do so much heat distortion in my...
How do you do them? Because I've done them where I've done particles and then used those through a kind of a lensing...
I actually think particles work the best as a way to do it, but you can sometimes achieve a similar effect in just a straight up 2D way with a, you know, a Perlin noise but I think you don't get quite the same kind of tearing.
Yeah, I think you get, yeah, exactly.
To see. And I think less so particles oftentimes work better, but it's not always the case on a show that you get the opportunity to get some effects DD to render out particles for thrusters. So it just depends on, you know, who's got time to do it, you know, if you're the compositor. And it looked like, to my eye, it looked like they didn't do that at all. And all we really got were some conical, you know, sort of soft fall-off blurs where those thrusters were, and I thought it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I think overall the film, you know, you either buy into the perky 60s go-go evil empire stuff and just go with it, which, let's face it, you know, I mean, amongst about a billion other things you need to go with to like these films, is not a hard ask, because it's not a gritty drama, it's a, you know, perky, you know, comic book film. But as a perky comic book film, it's a pretty bloody good one. There's probably some lack of to die for effects in this that would elevate it to kind of mega status. Like, it's not like, I don't think this is a film where I'd go like, you know, this is the benchmark that we've now set for X or Y.
I think it was more of a character driven film though, this one.
Yeah. I did too. Yeah, which I actually think is why it kind of rung true as a sort of a better film in a way. But I wanted, what did you guys think of the other big effect that I don't think we've talked about that was sort of throughout the film was the Mystique transition?
Yeah. Oh yeah, we didn't discuss that. Yeah, bad, my bad. Well, I thought that it's both spectacularly good and DNA confusing, the rippling effect of the transition. But if you're going to go with it, that's what it does. Like, I'm kind of not quite sure what I'm looking at. It is superbly executed, and I thought every one of those transitions just looks really, really interesting. The kind of scale flippy kind of thing. It's a really, really interesting way to do what could otherwise be a fairly dull morph between one to another. So I think it's great. Matt G, what do you think?
I think it looks great. The newer version, I mean, I completely get that it was groundbreaking, cool effects back when Synthespian Studios were doing it 11 years ago. I think it was Jeff Fleiser who was doing it then. But, you know, it was a lot more challenging and I think a lot more interactive with longer hair on this time on her Mystique. And I think the hair change color was really nice and good attention to detail, which 11 years later, hopefully we can do a bit better.
I, you know, obviously these things are derivative in the sense that they're meant to be because they're meant to be connected. But I would not say I could really fault those transitions. Matt, did you? I mean, you brought it up.
No, I guess, you know, it to me it's reminiscent of obviously the first time we see Mystique in the previous X-Men films. You know, it's similar, or it's, you know, a similar effect, if not the same effect. I do think they went a little bit further this time in trying to create a more sort of dynamic change overall. And they really let us look at it in a way that we hadn't really been able to look at it before. It felt like it was never something where they used some sort of gag to try to hide it so much as, you know, we just were really confronted with it. Like, it was really forefront in the scene. And it reminded me a bit of, you know, in more recent times, the Black Swan transition too. You know, it had a little bit of that going on in it as well. And I think overall, I liked it. There were a couple shots in there that, and you know, again, I think it's maybe similar to the diamond problem, in so much as it's something that, you know, like you said, you don't really know quite what you're looking at because it's such a strange, you know, sort of DNA bizarre reference, and going from a skin tone, or to use Stu's term, the porange color of the skin tone to the blue, you know, it's such a high contrast thing that it's really unforgiving. And if that track or if that comp isn't like 100% dead on, and if there's any slippage, you know, from the movement of the actress to the applique and the animation of the thing going on, like, I think it's, you know, I don't think it's really forgiving. So, I mean, I think the team that worked on those and got those shots dialed in, you know, really deserves some credit. It looks like, to me, that looks like something that, you know, well, it's sort of a background effect. We almost didn't even mention it, but I think it's something that if you didn't, You know, yeah. If you worked on those, I think my guess is those would be really difficult shots to achieve and to make look right. I would imagine.
And I would say the same thing about DD's stuff numbers. DD's thing on Shore when he's absorbing the nuclear energy, which to this day I can't understand why he was bothering to do that, as he didn't seem to use it. But it's like reverse the selenium rectifier. I'm going to absorb the nuclear power so I cannot do anything with it. But that could have been a dodgy effect, right? There were all sorts of theories about him, like, you know, bulging up as he sucked in the power and stuff. But the kind of weird morphy head distort thing was appropriately sinister, looked good, and because it looked good and because it was appropriately sinister, didn't really, in a film of 1,000 effect shots, draw attention to itself. Does that make sense? Like, it's good, mm-hmm. but it was appropriate, so it was not, didn't stand out from the film. So I mean, I feel bad for the DD artists that worked on it because it took a really long time to sort out, but in fact, just did what it needed to do. Now, plot-wise, I don't know why the hell it was there, but I guess it was harder to do and did definitely work at him absorbing the hand grenade on the back of the ship, which was a much more significant plot point than the nuclear reactor thing, because this is, I think, the first time we realized he was a mutant also.
Yeah, and it kind of had that. It kind of reminded me some of the contact wormhole kind of, you know, the streaking and the, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I think from an art direction point of view, a design point of view, like what is this thing that he can do, this power that he has, and how can we, you know, look for and find some way to articulate this so that visually you understand what's happening, but also, you know, it's something, one, that we can do, and that also looks cool. And in the notes, in the dossier that Todd threw together so quickly, which was great and had some great stuff in it, there was an article about that effect, and they actually had a couple instances where they had a fully CG Kevin Bacon as well in some of those.
Yeah,
they had 100 CG Kevin Bacons.
100?
Yeah, he was a full digi-double in 100 shots between...
100 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
The mirror room and also inside the FBI bunker and stuff like that. So there's a lot of Kevin Bacons.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other one we haven't discussed, but I guess it was sort of similar to the Mystique thing, was the... Now, I've lost the character's name, but it's the guy at the CIA thing that dies. He gets... When Kevin Bacon, Shaw puts
Darwin?
Darwin, yeah.
Darwin, yeah. Because Darwin was well done, and I was kind of sorry to see Darwin bite the dust, actually. I think Darwin was done by Luma Pictures as well, didn't they? They did him as well as...
And his death effect, where he kind of turns to sort of becomes sort of ashen and stuff, I thought was really great. That was a nice. He looked like the end of a, you know, an old cigarette or something, in the last bit of his life there. And I thought that was, it worked really well, and it was incredibly well integrated. It was a really nice, very tight composite as well.
Well, in finishing up, and to quote Charles and Eric, hopefully we have in us to be better VFX artists, and hopefully after you listen to this podcast, you'd agree with Eric and say we already are. But where can the guys find you? Matt, we want to track you down.
You can find me on my fabulous new website, Matt Wallin. It's MATTWALLIN.com, and all things me are located there.
Now, while I exist on the Twitters as Mike Seymour, and obviously mainly over at FX Guide, Matt, you shun the Twitters but embrace the Facebook, is that right?
Yeah, not so much for a global social networky so much thing, but I'm always loitering over at FXPhD as well.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank Todd for doing our research, and he's been suffering at the hands of my weird scheduling. As you guys know that listen to the show regularly, we are all working professionals, and everyone's... You know, schedule has to come into sync, and mine in particular was out of sync as I was traveling through the US, so Todd had to pull some stuff together really quickly. But that being said, Todd is working hard with our own Matt G to get not only this show, but a bunch of shows coming out in quick succession, which will be covering a lot of the summer blockbusters. We love summer blockbuster season, because obviously what drives summer blockbusters in no small measure is visual effects, and so that gives us a great opportunity to look at the work of people like Rhythm and Hughes, CineSite, Luma, DD, MPC, and Weta, and we... Shout out to those people that at those facilities that I know listen to the VFX show, which has been growing at kind of an astronomical rate in the last year or two, and we really appreciate the kind of support you guys have given us. We try and be as regular as we can inside the boundaries of the release dates of the films, and of course our own schedules. But look, if you've got any comments, please email us or talk to us, or just post on FX Guide in the comment section for the podcast. We'd love to hear you. We get suggestions all the time, and in fact, we get people coming back to us with some really interesting aspects. And so I'm thinking maybe that after we've done some of these retro shows, not like this one, but you know, the normal retro shows where we look back at things, we may actually do some quick takes over on FX Guide. Because I often get people that'll email us, that, oh, I used to work on that show, or I had worked at that company. I worked on that film that you discussed. A really interesting effect that I completely forgotten about was blah, blah, blah. And those little pearls are actually fascinating. And many years after the event, obviously a little easier to talk about. So we won't be doing an entire story on a film that's 10 or 20 years old, but it's great if we can just get some little interesting snippets and sort of stick them up there. So we might keep an eye out for that over at FX Guide. Thanks, guys, for being with us on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Until next time, we'll see you over at FX Guide. Thanks, guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.